Kia ora, Kitty. Thank you for having us on.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's my pleasure. We've spoken quite a bit about this take and the passion that you all have down there for the whenua, the maunga, the ngahere, the awa, and all of the animals and insects that are there, the bats and everything. But there's something exciting now that, it's a new way of getting out the kōrero. And so can you tell me about, before we start talking about the world premiere, can you bring us all up to speed on what the situation is at Mangapepeke?
Thank you, Kitty. I'm here with Tony Pascoe as well.
Kia ora,
So
Tony.
Hello.
Kia ora.
Tony might be able to tell the story of how the doco came about and how he met the filmmakers.
That sounds fantastic.
It was really, really interesting. I was out towards Waitrawa working on a place out there, and I seen these guys filming a well drill site at Motunui, and I thought, oh, they've got big cameras and all that sort of stuff. I wonder what they're up to. And it's like, what do I do? What do I do? Because emotionally I was pretty well shattered and all that sort of stuff, what was going on. So anyhow, I walked up the road and they run towards their van, and I thought, I can run too. So I run fast and run across the road, and I caught up with these guys and asked them what they're doing. And they said, oh, what are you here for? And I said, I don't know what you're doing. And I just told them the situation that I was in, because at that stage it was like, on my own, and it's like, I'm going to lose all this and whatever. And I explained to them what was happening, and I was crying and all that sort of stuff. And they went, oh. So they got in their van. I said, will you please get back to me at some stage? Yeah. And I said, oh, I'll never hear anything. Then met up with
Roberts.
Sarah Roberts to do with that situation. She was actually in the van, and we went to a thing at Egmont Village about it and about the fracking and all that sort of stuff. And then it evolved from there. These guys got back in touch over probably 12 months later, and then they come through Marie and Russell and Potama. They come to home and walked the valley and asked a whole lot of questions, and we did a whole lot of filming. And then they come back probably 6 or 8 months later and spent another weekend as well, when Marie and Russell were down in Wellington over a court of appeal, and Marie and Russell come called them that night when the guys were there. So it was pretty horrendous. So it's been a journey of bloody hell. It's come to a doco that's got into a festival, an international festival. So it's like pretty daunting, really. It's like pretty emotional about it and pretty worried, really.
Oh, I don't think you should be worried at all. I think you should be happy that your instinct drove you across the road to go and see those people and see, look what a little bit of advocacy does for you. Now it's going to be in an international film festival. And, at the end of the day, that's what it's all about. It's about, sharing what is happening, because so much of what goes on in our environment happens quietly. And so, when there's an issue like this, and I'm surprised that it's continuing. Can you bring us up to speed, Tony, on what the situation is? Has work started already? I see that there's been some big machinery in there.
Yes, there has. It started last year in May, with really speaking, the fact that we understand, and Marie and Russell know a lot more about than me, but under Condition 29 or whatever it's called, that none of this construction was supposed to start until all land was acquired under the resource consent. This is not supposed to be started under the conditions under the District Council. It's not supposed to be started until our land's been acquired as well. And then last year, I think it was early last year, they applied for another 80 million to put a tower, plus applied for more money for different things, and I can't remember what they are. They put a tower on top of Mount Messenger to be able to put a cable way in the top end of my galley, put diggers down there and that to start this tunnel. They've spent months with a helicopter flying out when native forest, which really distresses me, is cut in the bat population and the North Island robin and all those birds and native that's in there, they're cutting these trees down and flying out with a helicopter to places that out of resource consent we understand. So it seems to me they've broken every rule in the book and nobody's accountable for this. It's like district council should be stopping this because it's not in the regulation of what they're supposed to be doing. Regional council, NZTA, the NZTA board, they know about the online section option, Z option of a whole kilometre shorter for $200 million with no environmental damage. It's like... I spoke to him this morning on the thing and he said, where are you at with this, Tony? I said, I can't get my head around it because how can corporate get away with this and people that work hard all their life and all of us that are struggling to get somewhere into a particular environment and do the right thing financially, they're getting away with this.
Well, money talks, doesn't it? And I can understand where Duncan's coming from because it's a lot, you know, and when you've got so many entities like that all involved, and what it sounds like is that they're kind of either passing the buck to each other or they're just taking a really long time to get things done. And that's one of the hideous things about process and systems and bureaucracy. You know, it just takes forever to get things done. And and by the time you're getting them done, it's too late. Things just kind of sieve through instead of actually being dealt with. But, you know, it's not the first time that people have struggled. And I know, you know, there are many people around the motu that are struggling to understand how, when something isn't sanctioned, that it can go ahead. Or, you know, when it doesn't have the consents or doesn't have what it needs to have, how this is still happening. It's a travesty. And, you know, I'm certainly interested in looking into that more. But often you find that people are tight-lipped. You know, have you put in any official information requests?
We have put in a lot of official information act requests and they're ongoing. What it looks like to us is that there's no one that's actually putting their hand up to take responsibility for anything, anything that's happening. Except with the petition that's just been accepted into Parliament, Nicole McKee presented the Mount Messenger petition into Parliament in November, and that's the first time really that someone, you know, that someone in Parliament has actually stood up and said this needs looking at. This is a big issue and it needs looking into properly. And we were really thankful of Nicole McKee and ACT for, you know, taking that position. That
definitely has anything come of that? Well, even, you know, they're even slower at times, the old politicians.
Yes, it has. The petition got accepted in November and we put in our written submission probably about 2 months ago, I think it was. Then we understand the petitions committee starts carrying out an investigation. So it is confidential, but we understand what they generally do is go back to the government departments and the councils and that sort of thing and seek information on what the petition is and what our submission is.
Yes.
So that's kind of an independent, you know, when Nicole McKee said it needs looking into, that's what it does. And it's confidential, so they can have access to information that sometimes we don't. Like when we put an Information Act request, we get a lot back, but they're heavily redacted. So the Petitions Committee, we understand, because it's confidential, they can see the whole documents and have a good, you know, independent look over it.
That's frustrating, isn't it? You know, that when they get the black pen out and it can be hard to feel like you're fighting a battle with a hand tied behind your back because you don't have all the information.
Yeah, it is, but it just makes you actually look harder. Like when you start getting information back and you get a few things like, you know, they've their 206 million option Z that they'd hidden, when you start getting that sort of information back in the OIAs, it's a red flag that goes up. And, you know, and another one was an OIA that we did was on the when NZTA was blocking up those bat roosts with the builder's phone. Because we had heard about that on the grapevine and thought, you know, that's... Tony had heard about the arborist. Well, he'd seen the arborist in there.
Yep.
And someone had told him that they were blocking up bat roosts. And yep. Tony came to us. He was quite upset. And we kind of said, surely that's not what they're doing. You know, they wouldn't do that. So we put in an OIA to Department of Conservation and just said, you know, we've heard this. Surely it wouldn't be happening, but is there a possibility that it is? And they kind of stonewalled us and delayed a bit. But in the end, we did get an OIA back confirming that NZTA had blocked up those bat roosts with builder's foam and that DOC were a party to it. So the more you find out, the more it makes you want to look. And yes. And that's what's happened. Like, we've been in this for, you know, six to seven years now. And while it was hard, it was very hard going at the start. Like, we knew there was a better option, but and, you know, but we didn't have all the, and we felt like they weren't being honest with us and open, but you couldn't really prove it. But as time has gone on, we're getting all the information and more all the time. So, you know, I think it's quite a critical time at the moment. And it's starting to come out in the public more. Like, I think this documentary, it's quite a big deal. These two filmmakers, one of them's Ethan Aldis and Hughes. They're just two young Kiwi. I think they're probably in their 20s. Ethan Aldis and Hughes, he did a documentary on Ihu Matau.
Yep.
Yes.
And Michael Winiata, he's a director from Tauranga, and he did a non-verbal film called Kaitiaki, and they ended up in the same film festival a couple of years ago, and that's how they've kind of got together and they're collaborating on this one.
It must feel so good for you. You know, six or seven years to be fighting something and, you know, to have to be going through all of these OIAs and then all of the trying to look for somebody, anybody, to say, yes, this is my decision, you know, and this is why. And, you know, having that engagement, it must be so frustrating, but then so wonderful. Are you excited about the film? You must be, surely.
Yeah, we are.
It's humbling. I'm nervous about because I'm in it and whatever, but also with Ethan and Micah, there was also another young fella, Connor, that did a lot of the filming, a real nice young fella. I think he's working on his own things as well, but he was with them the whole time as well. So we're real appreciative of what they're doing, and they're nervous, we're nervous, but as you said, it's still exciting. But when you go back to Valley, which I did with a 12-year-old girl that I've known through relation and Keith, her father, to do some hunting to get some pork for different people, and you see Nekau palms and pungas and forest in the crystal clear stream that they've cut down and left in there, and the water's going brown. It rips my guts out. It's like, I grew up in this valley. I've known this valley forever, for my lifetime, and my mum before me. And this is not right. This is totally not right of what they're doing, because it's an alliance making a whole lot of money that was put in place before no resource consent. And all the land was not acquired for this job, so they're breaking all the rules in the book. Who is going to stand accountable for this?
Wow! And are some of these, you know, the kōrero that you're sharing with me, is some of that, you know, teased out in the film? Do you go into that? Is it like a, I don't want to give too much away, and we're going to be talking to one of the men who actually features on that, Homewana White. We're going to be talking to him next. But so I don't want you to give too much away. But, you know, is this, these kinds of issues, are these teased out in the film, or is it more about, you know, the beauty of what is going to be lost?
What the filmmakers wanted to do was to tell the story from the people themselves. So, So you get to see the issue from Tony's point of view, from Homewana's point of view, from Ngāti Tama's point of view. They've got a representative on there. They sort of gave the approval to NZTA to do this damage. So what the filmmakers wanted to do is they didn't want to put their own narrative or their own spin on anything, or put any words in anyone's mouth. They wanted people to tell their own story, and that's how it comes across. And yeah, they've done a brilliant job. It's amazing.
Well, that was a very good decision, hey Tony, to run across the road. So what, you know. Yeah, you're very passionate, Tony, and that's where that gets you, eh? It gets you heard. And my dad always had this great saying. He probably got it from somewhere else, but he always used to say, "Darling, the squeaky wheel gets the oil." Yeah. And so, you know, I've held that with me. He's full of great lessons. You know, I'm very much a product of my dad, and you know, some of his training. But it was wise. The squeaky wheel gets the oil. And hopefully, you know, with this, you get some oil, some relief.
And I think for us, the squeaky wheel is the valley itself.
Yes.
Like, you know, people ask Tony and Debbie, like, why are they doing this? Why are they doing this? Why don't they just, you know, give in? And, you know, it's been a long time and that sort of thing. Like, it's a pretty heavy burden on Tony and Debbie. But the squeaky wheel is really the valley itself, like when you go in there, and it's really the experience that everyone has when they come.
Yes.
They get it. They're in there and they just want to stay.
Yes.
And they understand that Tony and Debbie are not doing this for themselves. They're doing this to protect the valley itself. And that's the squeaky wheel, and we all feel it, like every time we go in there and when we're near there. That's why we're doing this.
And you've also got to remember that those massive trees, those massive stands of Nikau palms, and the huge amount of forest and the 47 plus species in there, they were all there before any Europeans arrived there, maybe before any other people arrived there as well. So, you know, this is that valley is unique to what it is and what's in there. And people say to me that, you know, it's ruined, this, that, and something else. If it's ruined, why is the 47 species in there? Why is the stream full of all the fish life and the ecosystem and the pristine water, but your cattle is destroying it? No, they're not. It's just a balance of life in there with a few cattle, a few pigs that feed other people, a couple of goats, very little possums, very little rats. I can take you up there, and I'd really love to take you up there, and you will not see rat prints in the silt, because rats walk over silt and all that sort of stuff. Very little possums. It's unique to what it is, and man's come along and they're going to take an existence away of an ancient forest that was there well before anybody else for a bloody road that's got no need for.
Yeah, there's something very, you know, very, very special about an old forest, and I've been in many forests, and you know, you can, there's a different modi, there's a different life force, a different energy in an old forest, and in an ancient forest. You know, it's a very different feeling. And if you can disconnect yourself from the rat race enough to go into a ngahere and have quiet, maybe take your shoes off and actually sit and smell and listen and, you know, let your body, they call it forest bathing. Forest bathing. But it's more than that. For me, I was doing it before I ever heard that term. But the feeling in that ngahere, it's, you know, you can almost feel the sense of all of the people that have been there before, all of the animal life that's been there before, all of the stories that those rākau must be able to tell. And it's a very, it is irreplaceable. And often, you know, this is my personal opinion, I find it mind-boggling that humans can come along and see something which is irreplaceable. You know, I challenge any human to be able to create that kind of majesty and spectacular chemistry and biodiversity, the ecosystem, how it, you know, when we think of the web of life, how beautiful it is, and that humans just have a habit of destroying it. And it really does hurt, Tony, and I know that you are like that. You feel those kinds of feelings. So I want to mihi to you both, and thank you so much for spending some time talking with me again tonight. And I have no doubt that you'll be off to the premiere. And we're just about now to have a kōrero with Homewana. He's online, so he's ready to tell us a little bit more about the movie. But just from myself and, you know, kaitiaki around the motu who have been following this story, I'm sure we all wish you the very best, and that, you know, in as much as you can, that you can save as much of that ngahere as you can and the life that is in there. And so thank you. Thank you, Marie. Thank you, Tony, for your time tonight.